The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with the weekend essay from the June 22, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker magazine. It's Mourning in America. In the past century, grief has shifted from a public process to a private problem, something meant to be solved. Is there a better way? By Cody Delastrati. In my childhood home, a modest, low-slung rectangle in eastern Washington, my mother was a bedroom away from me when she experienced her last moment. I remember standing in front of her, just after, feeling that I was watching a show or a movie, that this up-close experience was somehow false. I had never seen death in person before. I had, however, seen it frequently on my phone screen, on my laptop, on TV, in movie theaters. So what was I looking at here? At my mother's bedside, having never had the chance to confront serious loss in any substantive way, I was without comparison. In the following weeks, I struggled to accord what I'd seen with the world beyond our home. Looking around, it sometimes seemed loss and grief hardly existed at all. Today, in the U.S. and the U.K., death is largely banished from the visual landscape. A century ago, approximately 85% of Brits died at home. These days, it's closer to 25%, and around 30% in America. Many of those deaths have moved to the hospital, an often sterile environment where, as during the pandemic, loved ones are sometimes restricted from visiting. When individual bodies show up in newspapers, magazines, and social media, they tend to be exoticized, people not like us. When they are familiar, they have their faces turned away, as Susan Sontag wrote. Their identity is eroded, reduced, until they are more concept than person. We see this form of not quite death so often that one can be forgiven for mistaking, as I did, the curated depiction for the actual event. And then there is the stigma of grief. The idea, now rampant in American life, of closure. Most people are loath to linger in loss. We are expected to get back to work, back to normal. According to a recent survey, U.S. companies offer, on average, 5 days of bereavement leave, a remarkably brief amount of time to grapple with a death. For the death of a close friend, chosen family, the number drops to a single day. Typical mourning rites can seem to take closure to an extreme. At a funeral, loved ones may surround and console you for an afternoon, but we have few widespread customs that continue in the aftermath. This is in stark contrast to practices elsewhere, the Day of the Dead in Mexico, the Japanese Buddhist festival of Obon, which honors ancestral spirits, that prepare grievers to carry a loss for their entire lives. In America, the appeal of closure may be traced to On Death and Dying, the 1969 bestseller by the Swiss-American psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, that outlined the 5 stages of grief, ending with acceptance. Kubler-Ross has been widely misread by the public. Her original research was on how people coped with the prospect of their own death, not with the loss of another. As the social scientist Pauline Boss has pointed out, closure is a construct, something that can never fully be attained. Even if we grieve in stages, there is no prescription for how to grieve, much less for how to neatly overcome a loss. Boss suggests that closure's popularity is a product of America's mastery-oriented culture, in which we believe in fixing things, finding cures. With my own grief, too, I imagined a solution. I wanted to mourn quietly, persistently, toward a goal, until the pain, even the death itself, was nearly forgotten. Loss wasn't always obscured or seen as a trial to overcome. Throughout the 18th century, in much of Western Europe, death was witnessed directly and with little fanfare, according to the French historian Philippe Ares. Ares was well known for Western attitudes toward death from the Middle Ages to the present. His 1974 History of How the Social Construction of Death Changed Over Time. Observing an era in which mortality rates were much higher, he identified four distinguishing characteristics. The dying person was typically in his own bed. He usually had some awareness of his situation. He presided over it and knew its protocol. His family, sometimes even his neighbors, would join him at his bedside. And while he was dying, emotions were relatively measured, the death being expected, to some degree already mourned, and broadly understood as part of the flow of time. Although Ares has been criticized, sometimes fairly, for an over-reliance on literary sources and an idealization of the past, his core conclusion holds true. There was a social regularity and nearness to death that's largely foreign to many today. Ares used the term tamed death, nodding to how mortality was at the forefront of public consciousness. Even the trappings of mourning evinced this openness. In the 18th and 19th centuries, grieving women generally wore heavy black outfits that included veils and bonnets. Sometimes there were necklaces or bits of jewelry that contained the hair of the deceased. Both male and female mourners often used special stationery with black borders for correspondence. Over time, the borders would narrow to show readers that the bereaved party was slowly recovering. And death portraits, although creepy to contemporary eyes, were popular memorials, further elevating death's presence in the cultural psyche. In the 1900s, though, our relationship to grief seemed to change, transforming from a public, integrated phenomenon to a personal and repressed one. Some of this may have been prompted by the First and Second World Wars, which resulted in such multitudes of dead, men whose bodies were often unrecoverable, that the old rituals were no longer tenable. Other reasons were political, serving the needs of power. During the First World War, for instance, American suffragists marched against the prospect of U.S. involvement, noting the immense loss of life and the struggle it would create for women left alone at home or widowed. The protest's goal, per one suffragette, was to stretch out hands of sympathy across the sea to the women and children who suffer and to the men who are forced into the ranks to die. In the heat of August 1914, women paraded through Manhattan in traditional black mourning clothes. President Woodrow Wilson had run on an isolationist platform, but by 1917, the United States had joined the fray, and such demonstrations threatened his agenda. In 1918, conscious of the public's perception of the war, he wrote to Anna Howard Shaw, the former president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, asking that the suffragettes encourage women across the country to reframe their mourning as patriotism. Instead of mourning clothes, he had suggested, women could wear badges bearing white stars, which, upon the occurrence of a death, can be changed into stars of gold. At the time, the 19th Amendment was in the balance, and Shaw, who understood the importance of Wilson's support, obliged, asking her followers to dial back their public grief and change their dress. Instead of giving way to depression, It is our duty to display the same courage and spirit that they do, she said. If they can die nobly, we must show that we can live nobly. On July 7, 1918, the Times ran an article entitled Insignia, Not Black Gowns, as War Mourning, Women of America Asked to Forgo Gloomy Evidences of Grief. The article was penned between two stories about the terrors of the war, mustard gas warfare, and need of still larger armies. The 19th Amendment passed the next year with Wilson's endorsement. Across the Atlantic, Freud was rethinking mourning as a private pursuit. Perhaps grief was actually a form of work. He wrote in Mourning and Melancholia, and only upon that work's completion could the ego become free and uninhibited again. Death continued to recede from the public square. Walter Benjamin, in his 1936 essay, The Storyteller, notes how it had been relegated to the corridors of the hospital where the ill and the dying were stowed away. Silence, individualism, and stoicism became valorized, and talk of death and grief no longer belonged in daily interactions. Should they speak of the loss or no? The anthropologist Jeffrey Gorer wondered in his 1965 book, Death, Grief, and Mourning in Contemporary Britain. Gorer wrote, "Will the mourner welcome expressions of sympathy or prefer a pretense that nothing has really happened?" In his book, which drew from a survey of about 1,600 British citizens, Gorer suggested that people who choose pretense are less likely to sleep well and have strong social connections. Gorer, like Aries, attributed this shift to the pursuit of happiness having been turned into an obligation. The challenging aspects of life were now framed as individual burdens rather than shared setbacks. The quest for happiness has long been baked into the American psyche, but one can see its distortion in quasi-therapeutic concepts such as putting yourself first and emotional bandwidth. The notion that an uncomfortable emotion is an undesirable one and that we should set firm limits on certain discussions of hardship, even with intimate friends. Add to that self-care. Arguably the greatest marketing success of the 21st century, in which consumption is repackaged as a path toward well-being. And Aries' claim that we live in the era of forbidden death continues to resonate. The choking back of sorrow, the forbidding of its public manifestation, the obligation to suffer alone and secretly, has aggravated the trauma stemming from the loss of a dear one, Aries wrote. Citing Gorer, a single person is missing for you, and the whole world is empty. But one no longer has the right to say so aloud. After my mother's memorial, after we scattered her ashes, I decided to run a marathon. I was still looking for proxies for grief, situations where an external accomplishment could solve my inner turmoil. Needless to say, it didn't work. Not the running, not the hiking, not the strength training regimen. Grief was a different beast, one that couldn't be overcome through willpower alone. The historian Michel Vauvel challenged Aries' idea that forbidden death defined the West's attitude toward loss, or that death had even become taboo by the mid-20th century. Vauvel believed that the historian's job wasn't merely to look at shifts in the past. Why not look for these turning points in the present, he wrote. Indeed, to look at the current moment is to see an unusual evolution in which grief's privatization has given way to the blossoming of a new hybrid form. On social media, one often finds public grief that's rooted in private interests. when a statesman or a celebrity passes away, or when videos of a distant tragedy circulate, expressions of mourning can sometimes seem to be a mix of sincerity and performance, an opportunity less to confront death than to strategically display one's sympathies. Corporations issue statements of solidarity, which are, at bottom, advertisements. After the Boston Marathon bombing, the food site Epicurious tweeted, "In honor of Boston and New England, may we suggest whole grain cranberry scones." Crystal Abedin, an ethnographer of internet culture, calls this phenomenon publicity grieving. It returns grief to the public square, but in strange, vaguely unnerving forms. When millennials began taking funeral selfies around 2013, the trend sparked a minor media frenzy, eliciting think pieces and advice articles, including one from a casket-making company. The exploitative aspect of publicity grieving is obvious. Still, it's notable that collective mourning is once again part of the texture of daily life. The sociologist Margaret Gibson is clear-eyed about the turn. Death mediated by the internet, she notes, is not the same as death being intimately known and accepted. But she also recognizes the ways in which grief has been normalized, its effects allowed to emerge once more in social interaction. One of her studies focused on YouTube bereavement vlogs, videos posted by young people in the days and months after they'd lost a parent, in which they forge apparently genuine bonds with the strangers watching, sharing their pain, and showing how mourning continues across a lifetime. Elsewhere, initiatives such as The Dinner Party, a predominantly online meetup for people who have experienced a variety of losses, provide a kind of second space for grief, somewhere between normal life and the formalized privacy of a therapist's office. Even the funeral selfie takers seem, to me at least, to possess motives more benevolent than voyeuristic self-promotion. Perhaps they wanted to share their sense of loss, but were unsure how to do so, in person, without feeling like they were an encumbrance. A frivolous form of photography may not seem commensurate with the gravity of death, but approaching the subject with some amount of levity and candor may be precisely what we need. A decade on, I'm still figuring out my own grief. After completing the Paris Marathon, soon after my mom died, I didn't run for several years. Lately, I've taken it up again, cutting curling circles through the park near my home. The point I've begun to look forward to is no longer the finish line, but the moment when I begin to hit a psychic and physiological wall. In the past, I might have stopped, gone home, downed some Gatorade. It was painful. Now, I found some satisfaction in the unease, in living within the feeling rather than blasting past it. I see that my feet continue to move, that my breath persists. Sometimes it overwhelms me, but then I look up and see all around the park, others running, just as winded as I am, experiencing something of the same. Next, from the personal history section of the November 4th, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Finding the Heart. Religion often frames suffering as punishment. A family tragedy taught me otherwise. By Elaine Pagels. How do we heal the heart? As a historian of religion, I often return to the Gnostic Gospels, an astonishing cache of more than 50 sacred texts discovered in Egypt in 1945. Many of them speak to this question: how do we gain the courage to overcome grief and despair? In one story, Jesus' disciples, after his death, meet a doctor who calls himself a physician of souls, the literal translation of psychiatrist, who turns out to be Jesus himself. After revealing his identity, Jesus offers his followers a box of ointments and a medicine pouch, telling them to first heal people's bodies and then heal the heart. Since antiquity, people have spent enormous time and energy trying to do just that, whether through faith, medication, therapy, meditation, or physical activity. And though I've often grappled with such questions while poring over ancient sources, it was only when I faced an anguish beyond my imagining that they acquired a new, startling intensity. Do you have children? No, we very much hope to, but it hasn't happened yet. By the time my friend Mary Beth Edelson, an artist, asked me this question, my husband Hines and I had been married for 7 years, hoping, then longing, to be parents. We had been consulting with a fertility specialist for 3 years, and the painful treatments had created repeated cycles of hope and disappointment. When I told this to Mary Beth, she said, "Let's do a ritual for you. I only did it once before, but it worked." I was surprised and embarrassed, but also intrigued. Mary Beth lived in downtown New York in a large loft, creating rituals as performance art, in which she invited the audience to participate. After reflecting on the offer and discussing it with Hines, who found it amusing, I realized I had nothing to lose. Some weeks later, feeling nervous, foolish, and excited, I arrived at Mary Beth's loft with a few close friends, including the poet Sharon Olds. Mary Beth began by playing the sound of waves breaking on a beach. As we sat quietly, focusing on a large diorama. When the evening darkened, she lit candles and asked me to sit inside a large hollow sculpture shaped almost like a birth canal. Each participant, in turn, spoke about giving birth. During the final, intensely focused moments of our gathering, a sentence formed in my mind, startling me. "You don't have to do this. It does itself." 3 weeks later, I discovered that I was pregnant. The following October, on the Sunday morning of the New York City Marathon, we drove to the hospital. We were ecstatic when our son Mark was born. That afternoon, when a nurse took him to do a few routine procedures, I felt ferociously protective. The next day, the hospital's physicians, concerned about Mark's heartbeat, ordered an echocardiogram. I sat in the back of the room while they examined the images. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but caught the tone. Something was wrong. When they finally called us into a conference room, they told us that Mark was born with a hole in one of the walls of his heart. 5 years earlier, they said, a baby born with this condition invariably died. But since then, one of their pediatric cardiologists had invented an operation to make a repair, placing into the heart a plastic patch over which tissue could grow. Since operating on a newborn is especially risky, they advise us to delay open-heart surgery until his first birthday. We were hugely relieved to leave the hospital, take Mark home, and resume a semblance of a normal life. Mark smiled easily and was growing. At first, he slept in a tiny carrying crib next to our bed, where I often woke to check on him, breastfeeding, holding him close. After 6 months, he was sleeping in his own bedroom under a mobile of stars. At the time, I was a professor of religion at Barnard, and we usually left the city when the spring semester ended. That summer, we rented a one-room log cabin in a redwood forest in Santa Cruz. I remember Mark laughing often, especially when his father held him in his large hands. He was excited to learn to stand, first cruising around a low table and then holding onto my fingers with both hands, eager to see the horses grazing in a nearby meadow. In the afternoons, Hines and I walked barefoot on the beach, stopping to pick up shells and disentangle seaweed from our ankles. Below those idyllic days were currents of terror. When we returned to New York in September, we prepared ourselves for Mark's surgery, which was scheduled for later that fall. When the day came, we held Mark close as physicians injected him with a sedative and then strapped his small body onto a gurney and wheeled him into the operating room. After many hours, one of the surgeons emerged to say that everything had gone well. They'd made the repair. We went to see him in an intensive care unit where his slight body was pinned in a dense complex of intravenous needles. I had been ordered not to touch him, lest he risk infection, so I softly spoke to him. When he heard my voice, he lurched his whole upper body toward me, ripping out the needles on one arm. A nurse charged in, shouting, "Can't you see you're disturbing him? He's got to rest. You can't come in here." I fled, weeping. I felt in that moment that the nurse was right, that I was guilty of causing Mark's condition. Only much later did I realize the truth, that I'd rather feel guilty than helpless. Standing there, seeing Mark with a huge scar on his thin chest where the physicians had broken his breastbone, we were utterly helpless. Slowly, during the days that followed, Mark began to take in nourishment, regain some strength. The days and nights, previously indistinguishable, began to take shape again. On the 10th day after surgery, the physicians allowed us to sign Mark out of the hospital and carry him home, wrapped in his favorite blanket. Although pale, he beamed with delight to be back. Hines stretched out on the living room floor with him, and they began to build New York City out of bright cardboard bricks. The spring after Mark's second birthday, Mark's cardiologist, who routinely checked the results of the surgery, ordered a cardiac catheterization. The procedure was supposed to take an hour. 9 hours later, the doctors emerged, silent. A nurse summoned us to a conference room. "We couldn't believe it," one of the doctors said. "The surgical repair was fine. We thought he was well, but we kept getting the same result. Your son has a very rare disease, pulmonary hypertension, invariably fatal." Invariably fatal. I remember nothing else that was said until finally I asked, "How long?" "We don't know. A few months, maybe a few years." We resumed life in a universe irrevocably changed. Mark regained his energy, eagerly returning to preschool, where he and his best friend invented elaborate games involving stories known only to the two of them. Mark was excited to begin karate, learning to stand, kick, fight. Mercifully, his illness was invisible. He was thin, but otherwise he looked and acted like other children. When he was 3 and a half, we made the rounds of interviews for kindergarten. Since Mark's pediatrician knew the local schools, he agreed with our decision not to tell them of Mark's condition, lest they treat him like a China doll. I avoided saying, even to myself, like a dying child. Every morning that year looked gray when I woke up. I knew no one whose child had died, and I felt desperately alone. Even the ancients, who so often experienced the death of their children, called it the unbearable grief. I asked Mark's godfather, an analytic psychiatrist, to refer me to a colleague with whom I could talk freely to avoid inflicting emotional storms on Mark or Hines. While speaking with the compassionate, incisive man he recommended, I struggled with my powerlessness, which spurred an intense interest in magic. I felt I'd give anything to know how to do it, a spell, a cure, a bargain with invisible powers. How could we go on living, having no control over what mattered most? Hines and I fervently hoped for more children, but after a miscarriage, we began to talk with a priest at the Church of the Heavenly Rest in New York about adopting a child. He told us of the Gladney Center for Adoption in Texas. The agency agreed to consider us, and we flew down to Fort Worth, where we talked to 6 birth mothers and began the arduous application process. At the end of May, a social worker called to invite us to meet a baby girl, just born, who their counselors felt would be a good match for our family. Because she had been born prematurely, we were told that we'd have to wait until her due date, over 2 months later, to bring her home. Back to the cabin in California, to the horses, the meadows, the ocean. One night after dinner, Mark told me he dreamed that we were going to leave him in the cemetery that we drove past every day on our way to the ocean. I froze. Hines and I had agreed that we'd answer questions about his condition as directly as possible, but that we would not initiate talk about dying. As Mark described the dream, we made a drawing of it together. He drew grass, gravestones, and crosses, one with a stone angel on top. Talking with Mark about his dream, I felt apprehensive about the adoption. Could it suggest that we were preparing for life without him? The three of us held each other especially close that summer, spending hours in the treehouse in the redwoods and, in the afternoons, wandering by the ocean, marveling at the tiny crabs in the tide pools. Mark was thinner than ever, but I tried not to notice, and mostly succeeded. Days before we left, his gray parrot, who every summer for 3 years had gloried in sitting in the apple tree each morning, flew away. Mark was devastated. We looked and called for him all afternoon until long after dark, but we never found him. Shortly after we returned to New York, the adoption agency called to tell us that we could bring our daughter home. The three of us flew to Fort Worth, carrying a bag packed with baby clothes and blankets. At the hospital, the social worker invited Mark to be the first in our family to see his new sister. He returned, smiling and proud, helping to carry the baby in a small carrier. We'd already decided on a name, but seeing her, we realized that she would be leaving everything familiar to her, and it would be wrong to add any changes that we could avoid. We asked what they had been calling her. "We call her Sarah," the social worker said. Hines and I looked at each other and nodded. We liked the name. "She must be used to her name, Sarah," I said. Mark was eager to go back to school, where, with his teacher and his classmates, he was building a 6-foot wooden airplane in the woodworking shop. In October, we had to postpone his birthday party since he wasn't feeling well, but he recovered. We often took him and Sarah on weekend adventures, most often to the Museum of Natural History to see the dinosaurs, the giant squid, the jewels, and the planetarium's dazzling skies. Sarah was growing, laughing, babbling in her own language. She would scoot across the expanse of Oriental carpet and grab Mark's toys, the two of them playing and squabbling, inseparable siblings. 2 days before Christmas, Mark said he felt too sick to eat, and Hines took him to the pediatrician. When they returned, Hines' face was ashen. He signaled that we needed to talk. Our friend was there to care for the children, so we left and drove downtown. Hines told me what our pediatrician had said. "You should be prepared for a sudden demise, but don't tell your wife." Park Avenue was brilliant with thousands of crystal Christmas lights, and through the tears I felt every one of their points stabbing like needles. That evening, after Hines told Mark his bedtime stories, I went in to sing to him until he fell asleep. This time, he clung to me, arms around my neck, and said, "I'll love you all my life and all my death." I stayed with him until he went to sleep and then walked into the living room. Hines and I sat close, holding each other, shaking with silent sobs. I called his cardiologist the next day. When we arrived at her office, the nurse came in to draw blood. I was holding Mark on my lap. After she inserted the needle and left the room, he stiffened and his eyes rolled up. I ran down to the hospital hall, holding him in my arms, calling for help. Within 2 or 3 minutes, 6 or 7 physicians converged in a treatment room, placed Mark on a table, and worked to revive him while I stood over him, holding him close and speaking to him in a steady, reassuring voice. At a certain moment, I sensed that his life was leaving his body, and the intimate connection we'd shared seemed suddenly to break. Moments later, when his cardiologist arrived, I turned toward her and fell down, losing consciousness. Then I seemed to be in a brilliant place, vividly green with golden light. When I came to, I was in another room. A doctor had revived me with smelling salts. I opened my eyes to see Hines arriving in great haste, crying, "Oh, it's over, it's over." At that moment, I somehow felt that Mark could hear us. I sensed his presence near the ceiling of the room. Hines and I sat together, clasped tightly, and spoke to him. The cardiologist came in and told us that Mark's heart had stopped and then started beating again. We went to his room and held him, but he did not regain consciousness. Shortly after that, the heartbeats stopped. We stayed in the same room for 6 or 7 hours. His body and features changed as death took them over. After midnight, we walked out of the room, down the corridor, and out the back door of the hospital. Although we'd heard that many couples separate after the death of a child, Hines and I drew even closer, and closer was Sarah. We were surprised to admit to each other that in our devastation, we also felt some relief. The sword hanging over our lives had fallen. What we'd most dreaded had happened. Still, when well-meaning friends tried to soften our grief, speaking of the loss of your son, I inwardly froze and then flashed with anger. I didn't lose my child like a mother distracted while shopping. He died. Yet beneath the anger ran an electric current of guilt. Wasn't protecting Mark's life our primary responsibility? Hadn't we failed as parents? Suffering feels like punishment. That's one reason why people still tell the story of Adam and Eve, which suggests that human choice, the choice to sin, brought death into a once perfect world. Biblical stories often imply that those who die in a natural disaster or through catastrophic illness, even children mauled to death by wild bears for making fun of the prophet Elisha's baldness, are suffering exactly what they deserve. Over 2,000 years ago, Israel's greatest prophets, Amos, Isaiah, Jeremiah, interpreted their people's defeats in war as punishment for failing to worship God. This notion of suffering offers the illusion of control. If we believe that our pain is a form of punishment, then that pain isn't meaningless. We can respond by atoning, with prayer, with sacrifice, with self-abasement. We can retain some sliver of agency. When Mark was diagnosed, I sometimes felt as if I'd caused his illness. Although I wasn't a traditional believer and didn't take religious stories literally, somehow their premises had shaped my subconscious. Now I had to divest myself of the illusion that we deserved what had happened. In this, I was helped in part by my work, and especially by the Gnostic Gospels found in Egypt. One of them, the Gospel of Truth, bypasses the notion of suffering as punishment. it suggests instead that such experiences show how we're connected with each other and with God. This is what I felt at the service for Mark as we embraced friends at the back of the church. They had come from all parts of our lives, those close to us, those we hadn't met for years. I was grateful to see them, although I also felt strange, as though we were walking naked in public. Standing there, I had a vision of a vast net of thick ropes, with enormous spaces between the knots. Hines and I had found no meaning in our son's death. The most that we could do was create meaning by caring for each other and for our daughter. As we walked out of the church that day, I had the sense that those knots were our connections with those we loved, and that nothing else could have held us in this world. Next, a postscript from the June 21st, 2021 issue of The New Yorker. What Willie Mays meant. The late great ballplayer's myth had a specifically New York aspect, by Adam Gopnik. Everyone has seen it. In slightly decayed black and white footage, a center fielder, wearing the number 24, turns his back on a well-struck baseball and, apparently without looking and using some weirdly powerful instinctive positional guidance, races at top speed toward the stadium wall, and then reaches out in front of his body, back still turned, still running hard, and catches the ball. Then, in one fluid action, he spins and throws. It is Willie Mays of the New York Giants in Game 1 of the 1954 World Series, hauling in a shot by the Cleveland Indians' Vic Wertz. Thousands of plays have happened since, catches as magnificent, and many more meaningful. And yet, there it is, the one and only. It is possibly the seemingly both blind and sighted nature of the player as he runs that moves us so. He has an inner confidence about the intersection of his track and the balls, and knows what we don't, that he'll get there. A tenth of a second later and the ball would have dropped for extra bases. But there would be no such tenth. There's an illuminating study of the catch, from a scientific perspective, that emphasizes May's cognitive capacity for optical acceleration cancellation. That is, the ability to sense exactly when a struck object accelerating will begin to decelerate. Perhaps only Michael Jordan Airborne has had the same hold on our imaginations, and for the same reason. The athlete doesn't just do things we can't. He sees outcomes we are unable to envision. It is that dimension of sports, situational intelligence, as the jargon goes, or even more sapiently, anticipation, which stirs us. For a very brief moment, the great ones see ahead. It is a fleeting form of prophecy. Willie Mays, who died this week at the age of 93, may well have had that gift in greater abundance than any other player of his time, and this made him famous in ways that transcended baseball. When I was a kid, growing up in a baseball-loving family, for second-generation Jewish immigrant families like mine, reverence for baseball was as unquestionable as reverence for FDR. I always heard him automatically referred to as the greatest. I saw him play in person just once in Montreal in 1973 during his short, unhappy stint with the Mets, almost 20 years after the catch. Our own matchless baseball bard, Roger Angel, was so saddened by the spectacle of Mays in his later days, overmatched by curveballs he would formerly have slammed, that he wrote, "Hang 'em up, Willie." Mays is part of the larger lore of baseball, of course, but he is also part of the New York lore. Talkin' Baseball, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. A hit song of the 1980s celebrated the three New York 1950s Hall of Fame center fielders, Mickey being Mantle, and the Duke being Duke Snyder of the Dodgers. It enshrined a moment of municipal mythology, three gods, each with a role to play. Mantle was the voluble hayseed from Oklahoma who could hit anything but was corrupted by the big city and wound up undone by alcohol and knee injuries. Snyder was a silent cipher, letting dignity do the work, and no one described him as well as Philip Roth in a surprising intermission from other matters in Portnoy's complaint. On a sandlot, Portnoy becomes my King of Kings, the Lord my God, the Duke himself, standing there as loose and as easy, as happy as I will ever be, just waiting there for the ball to fall into the glove I raised to it. Between those poles of effervescence and reserve, Mays was the happy warrior, the say-hey kid, playing stickball with the neighborhood children in Harlem as freely as he played center field at the polo grounds. It was easy for many Americans who watched him play in the 60s and early 70s to underestimate the sheer brutality of the racism he was confronting. In memory, it is Jackie Robinson, Mays' courageous predecessor, who bore the brunt of that fight for what was depicted for years as bold individual self-assertion, but which was really a long overdue claim of minimal civil rights. The takes, visible on documentary film, of Mays playing stickball up on St. Nicholas Place are also reminders that New York at that time was largely segregated. In some ways it still is. And then we use words like instinctively and naturally to celebrate Mays' perfection of form, when more purposeful language might be helpful. No more interesting point has been made about him than Tim McCarver's, that Mays was so knowing he would sometimes deliberately miss a hittable curveball in hopes that the pitcher would therefore try it again later in a more crucial circumstance. Yet, we keep him close as a local hero. New York baseball, though it continues to thrive, has essentially two historic high points. One was the period from 1908 to 1923, when the Giants emerged as arguably the first great National League team, and the Yankees, with Babe Ruth, built the foundation for the greatest dynasty. This had something to do with the emergence of tabloids, which offered good writers places to discuss the burgeoning business of baseball. The second was Mays' era, and it too had to do with the media, both the infancy of television, which was feeling its way around the game, and even more the dominance of radio broadcast. It's no accident that Roth, describing the Duke, also mentioned the announcer Red Barber, whose locutions were so instantly recognizable that they underpin one of the greatest New Yorker short stories, James Thurber's The Catbird Seat. In those days, three teams were near one another, on the radio dial, as used to be said, and even their specific sponsors remained part of New York lore. Ballantyne for the Yanks, Schaefer and Lucky Strikes for the Dodgers, Knickerbocker and Chesterfields for the Giants. The midsummer sounds of baseball broadcast, fixed in form then, are still classic, an inherited essence of the game. A fog of nostalgia shrouds everything we recall, but we shouldn't fail to notice that the two mainstays of baseball advertising were alcohol and tobacco, far more toxic and doubtless responsible for more human disease and suffering than later addictive drugs like cocaine and steroids, about which we feel licensed to be censorious. Barry Bonds, Mays' godson and his closest successor, has been kept out of the Hall of Fame for his steroid scandal, his sad decline and permanent place in purgatory, in which he's joined, for other reasons, by Pete Rose, is typical of our obsessively punitive time. This is surely part of the reason that the purity of the thrill that our grandparents got from Mays and his peers is not reproducible now. It was also, if not delusional, illusory, oversimplifying complex lives and trajectories into a handful of images and memories. And so, Mays remains. The value of sports, as the philosopher C. Tyngun writes, is that although the activities themselves may seem arbitrary or trivial, hit this ball into a pasture so far that it can't be caught, or then try to catch it, chasing such goals creates new paths of agency and aspiration for us to mimic inside ourselves. Oh, the unruffled nonchalance of that game, with Ross's concluding remark about New York baseball in the 40s and 50s. If we feel that nonchalance today when we watch Mays, it's because it models the possibility of being at once urgent and at ease, racing as hard as humanly possible to make the play, with the secret knowledge that you will indeed make it. That double pursuit, outwardly hard-charging and inwardly serene, is the epitome of grace in every human endeavor. Just the other night, Connor McDavid showed again how it is done in hockey. This is what makes sports matter. To borrow an image from Angel, all the rest of us do in life is run down uncatchable balls, drop them, and then pretend we haven't. That's why seeing one perfectly caught is so satisfying that we'll never stop watching it, even after the catcher has left center field for good. Next, from the letter from the Southwest Department of the June 13, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker, the decline of the Rio Grande. When the water runs out, there are no good options. One of the poorest regions in Texas faces an uncertain future, by Rachel Monroe. As its name indicates, the Rio Grande Valley gets much of its water supply from the Rio Grande, which for about 1,000 miles forms the border between the United States and Mexico. According to a 1944 treaty, Mexico is supposed to provide an average of 350,000 acre feet of water per year from its tributary rivers to replenish the Rio Grande. But in the past 4 years, it has supplied far less, sometimes nothing at all. This year's Mexico's own reservoirs were so low that the prospect of fulfilling the treaty terms was hydrologically impossible. Bobby Janeca, who heads the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, wrote in February to the International Boundary and Water Commission, "They're continuing to use the water that's owed to us," Sean Brashear, the president of the Rio Grande Valley Sugar Growers, told me, "and that leaves us going out of business." The issues with the Rio Grande reflect a greater crisis in the American West. In recent years, low water levels at Lake Powell and Lake Mead, which are fed by the Colorado River, have caused considerable alarm. But the levels at the Rio Grande's two major reservoirs in Texas, Amistad and Falcon, are even lower. Farmers in the Rio Grande Valley are bracing for the possibility of a summer with very little water allocated for irrigation, a prospect that could result in the loss of nearly $500 million of revenue for one of Texas' poorest regions. In late May, I took a trip along the Rio Grande in Texas. These days, the third longest river in the continental U.S. is essentially two rivers. The first section begins at the headwaters in Colorado and runs through New Mexico, where much of its flow is diverted into reservoirs for municipal and agricultural use. By the time the river reaches El Paso, it dwindles to a thin, polluted stream. East of El Paso, in an arid region called the Forgotten Reach, the Rio Grande, fed by no major tributaries, largely disappears underground for almost 200 miles. But just before Big Bend National Park, a second section begins to flow, replenished by water from Mexico's Rio Conchos and further downstream, half a dozen other tributaries. Per the 1944 treaty, the U.S. gives Mexico 1.5 million acre-feet of Colorado River water each year, and Mexico supplies 1.75 million acre-feet to the Rio Grande in a five-year cycle. To satisfy the terms of the current cycle, Mexico would have to deliver more than a million acre-feet of water by the deadline in October 2025, an unlikely scenario given the levels of its own drought-stricken reservoir. Last month, a bipartisan group of Texas lawmakers asked Congress to withhold aid from Mexico if the water debt is not paid. But the focus on Mexico has been a distraction from Texas' own water issues. The state government refuses to consider how its water problems are being exacerbated by climate change, which contributes to rising temperatures, more erratic weather patterns, and higher evaporation rates. Texas doesn't talk about climate change, Kathy Robb, a longtime water attorney, told me. And although the state has begun to address the looming water crisis, it likely hasn't gone far enough. Last year, the legislature approved a $1 billion plan to shore up the state's water infrastructure, but the allocation is significantly less than what experts say is necessary. During the same legislative session, lawmakers appropriated more than $5 billion for the state's border security efforts, including more than $600 million to build a border wall. Martin Castro, the director of watershed science for the Rio Grande International Studies Center, an environmental advocacy nonprofit based in Laredo, called this a situation of misaligned priorities, arguing that the border security funds would be better invested in drought planning or in technologies that help ensure water security. Here, the prevailing mindset is that sometimes we don't act until it's a bit too late, Castro said. A big paradigm shift needs to happen. If things don't improve, we're going to be in serious trouble. 3 years ago, Laredo issued a report warning that the city was at risk of running out of water by 2040. The city's sole source of water is the Rio Grande. But that was only looking at population increases. They didn't look at any other factors, like the impact of climate change, Castro told me. And so us running out of water might happen much sooner. Castro, too, said he was praying for a hurricane or at least a tropical storm. What else is going to save us at this point? We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you very much for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.